Regular viewers of this channel will know that for several years I have been investigating the mysterious death in British captivity of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler. I've made an entire series about it, link in the end screen, not to mention several standalone programs about Himmler and his murky wartime negotiations with Winston Churchill, MI6, other Allied leaders and intelligence services. One aspect of the death of Himmler that has bothered both me and some earlier researchers is a slab of time strangely unaccounted for in the records, and a belief that Himmler was in British custody far longer than is officially admitted, and that he was, despite what the British official record suggests, interrogated before dying under deeply suspicious circumstances. I recently made a bit of a breakthrough in trying to answer these questions when I found evidence, hidden apparently in plain sight, that Himmler was questioned by officers not mentioned in the official record, and evidence of a different scenario concerning his unmasking as the Reichsfuhrer SS than that told in the history books and elsewhere. Evidence from an unimpeachable and respected source that I never realized had anything to do with Himmler or his demise. And the source of this new information is none other than one of World War II's most famous test pilots, Captain Eric Winkle Brown. In the world of aviation, Eric Brown was up there with Chuck Yeager and other flying legends. A Royal Navy pilot, Brown was a fighter pilot turned test pilot who officially flew an astounding 487 different types of aircraft, a Guinness World Record. He also held the world record for the largest number of carrier landings, 2,407, or more than 20 aircraft carriers during the war. He was awarded the Distinguished Service Cross for combat actions earlier in the war and made a member of the Order of the British Empire for his test pilot activities. Post-war, he was made an officer of the Order of the British Empire and later upped to commander, also being awarded the Air Force Cross and the King's Commendation for Valuable Service in the Air, and retired in 1970 with the rank of Naval Captain. Eric Brown died in 2016 at the age of 96. My programs generate a lot of emails from viewers, and some of them suggest new lines of inquiry or new evidence that I sometimes research further. How I came to this new information about Himmler was, like most things, quite by chance. I was emailed back in June concerning the death of Hermann Göring in 1946, and the story concerned Eric Brown, who of course spoke and wrote about his interviewing Göring as part of his duties in Germany at war's end, investigating high-tech Luftwaffe aircraft. Looking into the story, which is outside the remit of this program, but let's just say the sources indicated that there may have been more to Brown and Göring's meeting than officially admitted to, I looked up some online interviews made of Eric Brown before his death and was stunned when he started discussing meeting not only Göring but also Heinrich Himmler. Here is the segment of an interview conducted with Brown at the RAF Museum, Hendon, in London some years before he died. I am indebted to the interviewer, Nicholas Jones, for kind permission to use this film, which is from Eric Brown, a pilot's story, available on DVD from its producer, Quanta Films. Check out the link in the description box.
What about Himmler?
Yes, I had a very short interrogation of Himmler just before he committed
suicide.
And he was the absolute opposite of Göring. He really had not much to say for himself, and he always took refuge in the fact that he said he was acting entirely under orders from higher authority. I did ask him only one real question about aviation. I had heard that at one stage he had arrested, around about 1943 I think it was, he had arrested Werner von Braun, who was their top rocket man. So I asked him why this took place. And he said that he thought von Braun had lost interest in helping the war effort, but was devoting too much time to his visions of space travel. And this was the reason he withdrew him from, if you like, the rocket scene for a short time. I think it was only about 3 months.
Knowing as I do an awful lot about Himmler's last days, I had no recollection of any document or history book regarding this subject mentioning his being questioned by a certain Fleet Air Arm test pilot. When did this occur? I didn't have a copy of Brown's autobiography, but a quick check online revealed that my local library in Norwich certainly did have, so I hot-footed it down there and dug out the book from the stacks and began looking for references to Himmler. The only reference to the Reichsfuhrer SS is of Brown test-flying Himmler's personal Focke-Wulf FW-200 Condor plane. His autobiography contained absolutely no other references to Himmler. His meeting with Göring, whom he seemed to like very much, was of course included in the book. So what's going on? Perhaps someone like Brown, privy to classified material concerning German weapons and also British weapons, undoubtedly had to submit the manuscript of his autobiography to the Ministry of Defence to ensure that it didn't contravene any secrets, then still current, at the time of publication. But Brown definitely spoke about meeting and questioning Himmler, as you've seen in the interview clip. He did this towards the end of his long life, when he was very elderly, but still sharp mentally. Had Brown let something about Himmler out of the bag? Was he too old to care anymore whether his apparently innocuous talk with Himmler contravened any official secrets? And more importantly, why had no other historians noticed this admission, which had been in the public arena for years? Was Brown telling the truth? He certainly had an excellent reputation for doing so, and I see absolutely no reason to disbelieve him on any other subject. But his autobiography was very interesting in that, like so many of the reminiscences or private papers of people involved in the last days of Himmler's life, it has a gap during the period when Himmler was in British custody, which is suspicious when placed against what Brown was saying in public interviews. Because none of the official reports or histories mention Himmler being interrogated, when did Brown have access to Himmler to ask him his questions? And why did none of the other officers who dealt with Himmler mention this, despite noting the names, ranks, and units of other personnel involved in Himmler's capture and brief stay in British captivity? None of it makes any sense. So within the existing timeline, is there a chunk of time not properly accounted for between Himmler's apprehension by the British and his death? Yes, there is. Let's firstly recap Himmler's movements, as officially noted by the British authorities, based upon their interrogations of members of Himmler's staff that were captured alongside of him. Following a last meeting with Hitler at the Reich Chancery in Berlin, the 20th of April 1945, Himmler had then been busy for several days, conducting his illicit negotiations with the Western Allies via Swedish envoy Count Volker Bernadotte, and he had also met a representative of the World Jewish Congress in an attempt to build bridges, which, in light of the Holocaust, appears an extraordinary gambit. Some Scandinavian Jews were indeed ordered released by Himmler as part of these negotiations. He moved headquarters several times, taking himself further away from Berlin as the Red Army's advance threatened his safety. On the 24th of April 1945, Himmler had moved from Wustrow to the SS sanatorium at Hohenlicken. However, on the 26th of April, Himmler moved again, this time northwest to Schwerin, as he positioned himself closer to the final seat of government in the north, that of Grand Admiral Karl Dönitz, appointed by the Führer as Commander-in-Chief of all German forces in northern Germany, Denmark, northwest Netherlands and Norway. In due course, Dönitz would succeed Hitler as the last Führer of Nazi Germany, and Himmler was keen to play a role in any new government. On the 28th of April, Himmler was officially disgraced when Hitler discovered, via a BBC radio broadcast, that the Reichsfuhrer had been secretly offering to surrender Germany to the Western Allies in return for his gaining authority over what remained of German-controlled territory in northwestern Europe and his cooperation with the Western Allies in keeping peace inside Germany. Rebuffed by the British and declared a traitor by Hitler, Himmler nonetheless remained a powerful figure with a large escort unit and with large numbers of his SS providing the administration for the new Dönitz government, which was declared on the 1st of May 1945, the day after Hitler's death in Berlin, and would in fact last in power until the 23rd of May. On the 6th of May, Himmler received a written order dismissing him from his offices of state. From around this date until the 11th of May, Himmler and his close associates installed themselves in a new headquarters at Zattrup using a requisition farmhouse. According to the official history, the 10th of May, Himmler, five other officers and about 10 NCOs left the Flensburg area, travelling south in four large field cars. Abandoning the cars at Marne, on the 12th of May, the group was ferried across the Elbe River from Brunsbüttel to Neuhaus on the south bank of the Elbe. For the next 5 days, the group proceeded on foot, disguised as a group of Geheime Feldpolizei, or Secret Field Police NCOs, going home to Bavaria. They were now in the British occupation zone of Germany. On the 18th of May, the group reached Bremerwerde and moved into a farmhouse at Waldstrasse outside the town and made preparations to cross a guarded bridge across the Oster River and then continue south. The 21st of May, two members of Himmler's party, SS-Sturmbannführer Josef Kiermaier, Himmler's personal aide, and his surgeon, SS-Obergruppenführer Dr. Karl Gebhardt, approached the bridge at 3 p.m. Around 4 p.m., they were stopped by Sergeant Kenneth Baysbrown of 1003 Field Security Reserve Detachment, British Army Intelligence Corps, and questioned. Baysbrown noticed that the stamps on their false identity documents appeared to be wrong and was immediately suspicious. Baysbrown sent two lorries and an escort to collect the other members of the Himmler group, all pretending to be Geheime Feldpolizei NCOs. But unfortunately, they didn't realize when they made up their false IDs that membership of the secret field police was an arrestable category at the time in the British zone. The lorries returned with the rest of the group except three men: Reichsführer Himmler and his adjutants, SS-Obersturmbannführer Werner Grotmann, and SS-Sturmbannführer Heinz Macher. The arrested group were interrogated. Sergeant Arthur Britton, who was actually Dutch, assisted by Baysbrown, took the youngest member of the party into the British Field Security Detachment headquarters, Loser's Mill, behind the bridge. The young man admitted under interrogation that they were all field security police and that the stamps in their documents were issued by SD headquarters. At this point, I believe that Britton and Baysbrown probably got more out of the youngest member of the group than they ever admitted to, as they interrogated him strongly. I think this young SS NCO probably admitted to being with Himmler, and that Himmler was one of the three missing men. This is speculation on my part, but I think it quite likely. At 6 p.m., all the Germans were sent by lorry to Westertimke internment camp for processing. Except for General Gebhardt, he was driven to Himmler's last known address, the farm at Waldstrasse. The call went out to all units to be on the lookout for three secret field police suspects on the run in the area. On the 22nd of May, the history books say that Himmler and his adjutants tried to cross the bridge at Bremerwerde and were arrested and questioned at the mill, Himmler officially not being identified at this time. Another version of this story is that Himmler and his two adjutants were picked up at a checkpoint by two recently released Red Army soldiers at Meinstedt, 20 kilometers south of Bremerwerde, on the 21st of May, and these three characters were then handed over to the British and driven to Bremerwerde. According to the history books, Himmler and his companions spent the night of the 22nd to 23rd of May sleeping on flour sacks in the corner of the mill. At 7 a.m. on the 23rd of May 1945, Himmler and his companions were driven to the camp at Westertimke, where the rest of the party had already been taken, headquarters of the British 45th Field Security Station, arriving at 9 a.m. They were then driven 45 miles to Kulkhagen Interrogation Center near Barnstedt, arriving at 6:30 p.m. So, we are supposed to believe that a 45-mile truck journey took 9.5 hours. Himmler and his companions were booked in to the number 31 civilian interrogation camp at Kulkhagen at 6:30 p.m. The records unequivocally showing this. At 7 p.m. the camp commandant, Captain Thomas Sylvester, was informed that three Germans were demanding to see him. Himmler then identified himself to Sylvester, who immediately telephoned 2nd British Army headquarters at Lüneburg, speaking to Intelligence Corps officer Major Reiss, who initially didn't believe him. However, Reiss then agreed to rush over to Kulkhagen immediately. In the meantime, Sylvester ordered Himmler strip-searched and his clothes examined, and then he gave Himmler tea and thick cheese sandwiches, which he apparently ate, despite the official story of him having a glass ampoule of cyanide concealed somewhere in his mouth. Himmler was also possibly allowed to wash and shave, which was against regulations. Sylvester later denied this. At about 7:30 p.m., Major Reiss arrived. Himmler was then identified via a copy of his signature, a photograph of him in uniform, and asking him to recite his SS and Nazi Party numbers, which didn't quite match the numbers the British had on record. He was very chatty and cooperative, hardly the demeanour of a man shortly to take his own life. He also discussed a letter that he had been carrying addressed to Field Marshal Sir Bernard Montgomery, commander of the British 21st Army Group. This letter has never been seen again. Reiss returned to headquarters at Lüneburg and spoke to his boss, the head of intelligence, British 2nd Army, Colonel Michael Murphy. Murphy now left to see Himmler, but for some reason didn't arrive until 9:45 p.m. Was he busy doing something else, perhaps preparing a special house in Lüneburg where Himmler would be brought later? Murphy was aggressive towards Himmler from the get-go, calling him various names and using threatening behaviour. He also ordered him strip-searched for a second time. At 10:45 p.m, Himmler was bundled, half-dressed, into Murphy's car and driven to Lüneburg, to a house being used for interrogations. The address, 31A Ulzenerstrasse. On arrival, Himmler was strip-searched for a third time, and then examined under Murphy's orders by a British Army medic, Dr. Wells. In the presence of Wells and Company Sergeant Major Edwin Austin of the Headquarters Defence Company, British 2nd Army, Himmler apparently managed to take poison during the medical examination and was declared dead around midnight on the 23rd of May 1945. So according to the histories based on official reports, there are only a few periods of time when Erich Braun could have spoken to Himmler. These are between 9 a.m. and 6:30 p.m. on the 23rd of May 1945, during the inexplicably lengthy transit between Westertimke and Kulkhagen camps. A 9.5-hour window existed here. Secondly, between 7 and 10:30 p.m. when Himmler was in the custody of Captain Sylvester, Major Reiss, and latterly Colonel Murphy at Kulkhagen camp, a period of 3.5 hours. And thirdly, the period between arrival at 31A Ulzenerstrasse and Himmler's death at midnight on the 23rd of May, a period of less than 1 hour. That is it. Yet at no point in the official records or any of the history books is the presence of Captain Braun officially noted or mentioned. There is no record of him having questioned Himmler. This lends weight to a contention myself and several other researchers have that Himmler was actually in British captivity far longer than is being admitted, and that he was properly interrogated. The basis for this claim is that Himmler was indeed picked up on the 21st of May by Red Army soldiers working for the British at a checkpoint, and more than that, he was identified as Himmler that same day, and not on the 22nd of May, as all records suggest. So how does all this official evidence of Himmler's movements fit with Braun's oral and written testimonies? Braun's fluency in German was to be utilized by the Air Ministry to organize classes in German for scientists who would shortly be sent to Germany to investigate German technology. Braun was declared commanding officer, enemy aircraft flight at the Royal Aircraft Establishment, Farnborough. In mid-April 1945, he was ordered to stand ready for departure to Germany. Braun landed by air with the first contingent of British scientists and technicians at an airbase not far from Belsen concentration camp. After dispersing his men, Braun was chatting in German to Luftwaffe ground crew at the base when he was approached by Brigadier Glyn Hughes, 2nd Army Medical Director. Glyn Hughes would be the officer that ordered a post-mortem examination of Himmler shortly after his death, but incredibly neglects to mention this or anything about Himmler's death in his official papers, which I examined in London. Rather odd, considering how famous Himmler was. Almost as if he was told not to mention any of it in any official record, for some reason. Glyn Hughes called Brown over and said, "You speak better German than my translator. I'd like you to come on a 2-day mission with me." Brown replied that he could give him 1 day. As well as attempting to sort out the horrendous humanitarian crisis at Belsenkamp, Glyn Hughes was also interested in unofficially interviewing certain German personnel, including the Commandant, SS Hauptsturmführer Josef Kramer, and the head of the Women's SS section, Irma Greiser. Brown translated during both of these interrogations. Following this, Brown and his men headed for the main objective, Husum Luftwaffe Base, where a grouper of JG-400 was based with cutting-edge Messerschmitt Me-163B jet fighters. All of the jets were captured intact. Following this, Brown was ordered to Denmark, to the night fighter base at Grover, to obtain an Arado AR-234B jet bomber for study by the British. He flew from Husum to Grover in an RAF Avro Anson, and the German commanding officer surrendered his airfield and 2,000 men to him and the RAF aircrew. Brown now flew back to Schleswig-Holstein using a captured Focke-Wulf FW-190 fighter. He flew over Flensburg, noting a lot of German ground activity, and when he tried to land at Flensburg airfield, which is of course close to Grand Admiral Dönitz's final Nazi government, he was met by small arms fire and flew off to Schleswig instead. At Schleswig, an intact Messerschmitt Me-262 was captured, and Brown test flew it. Brown now claimed, in his autobiography, not to have been present in Germany during the period when Himmler was captured and died. He says that he was ordered to the Royal Aircraft Establishment to carry out the first test for deck landing potential of the new de Havilland Vampire jet fighter. This test occurred at Hatfield on the 19th of May 1945, when Himmler was then in hiding at the farmhouse outside Bremerwerder. He says that he was due back in Germany, but was suddenly given a new assignment. A signal had been received from the British Air Attaché in Dublin, Ireland, concerning a German Junkers Ju-88 night fighter that had flown to the Irish Republic, the crew having been interned. The Irish government was happy to hand the plane over to the RAF. Brown claims, in his autobiography, that this operation took place on the 2nd of June 1945. Himmler was, of course, dead at midnight on the 23rd of May. On the 17th of June 1945, Brown met Hermann Göring at the Hotel Mondorf camp in Luxembourg and interviewed him as part of his duties. But in the oral interview, Brown admits to being in Germany for part of the time he officially wasn't in his autobiography. In a public lecture Brown gave in Cambridge on the 5th of April 2014, he said the following, quote, "I was at an airfield called Selver, which is quite near this village called Barnstedt, and I got a call from the headquarters saying, 'Look, in peacetime you've seen Himmler at big parades. We heard you say he walked in a peculiar manner. Would you come and identify this guy we have?' So I agreed, and as soon as I walked in, I knew it was him. He didn't have to walk up and down, but we made him do so." End quote. All official records state that Himmler was only identified at Barnstedt camp, that is Kolkhagen, once Major Rice had arrived with a copy of Himmler's signature, an official photograph of him in uniform, and the details of his 2 identity numbers. There is no mention of an officer being brought in to visually identify Himmler based on having previously seen him in person, or that Himmler had a peculiar walk. Brown continues, quote, "I said to him, the intelligence chap, 'Can I interrogate him?' They said, 'No, you can't.' I said, 'Well, let me ask him 2 questions, just to prove his identity. Only he will know the questions.'" End quote. In his talk, Brown only repeats the Werner von Braun story from his RAF Museum interview. What the other question was, we don't know. To be honest, these questions would have been vital to establishing Himmler's identity, but the asking of these questions is completely left out of the official story. Why? probably because Brown and representatives of other interested agencies actually interrogated Himmler in more detail and for longer than has ever been admitted. Brown said that he was near Barnstedt when intelligence contacted him to help identify Himmler. Kolkhagen camp was at Barnstedt, which he mentioned. Himmler allegedly didn't reveal his identity to Captain Sylvester till 7 p.m. And Major Rice arrived at 7:30 p.m., with Colonel Murphy arriving at 9:45. Himmler left for Lüneburg at 10:40. That is a window of 3 hours 40 minutes for British intelligence to work out that a naval officer named Brown is in the area on Air Ministry business and that he had seen Himmler in person before the war. Then Brown had to be located, contacted, and told to come over and help identify the suspect. Seems a bit tight to me, and also rather coincidental. Surely the Air Ministry would have been interested in specifically asking Himmler questions about the V-weapons program. The V-2s, of course, had been taken over by the SS in 1944, and especially due to the fact that Himmler's man who was running this program, SS General Dr. Hans Kammler, had disappeared into thin air at war's end and was never found. Did Brown leave us a rather big clue, that apparently innocuous question about Wernher von Braun? I don't think it was particularly coincidental that Captain Brown was in the room with Himmler. The story is, of course, more believable if Himmler was in British custody for longer, and evidence does exist for this. I'll come back to that in a moment. However, Brown mentioned other things in other interviews. In an interview with BBC Scotland, he mentioned some more details of how Himmler was identified, which absolutely clash significantly with the established story. If you recall, when Himmler and his two adjutants arrived at Kolkhagen camp near Barnstedt, they were still believed to be 3 Geheimefeldpolizei NCOs. However, Himmler was apparently recognized by several German prisoners at the camp who saw this group arriving, including the former Gauleiter of Hamburg. Realizing he couldn't pretend to be Heinrich Hitzinger, as his forged papers stated, he forcibly requested an interview with the camp commandant, Captain Sylvester, during which he voluntarily admitted to being Himmler. This is not the story according to Brown, which is so at variance with the official story that I suspect Brown was telling the truth and Sylvester's account was a fiction dreamed up with Major Rice and Colonel Murphy of British Second Army intelligence to cover the fact that Himmler was in British custody for longer than admitted. Brown's story was this, quote, "This chap called himself Heinrich Hitzinger, and his papers were forged. But the warrant officer kept at him and at him. Eventually he got mad with this thing, and he said, 'I'm Heinrich Himmler,' and the warrant officer said, 'Yes, and I'm Julius Caesar.' He didn't believe him at all," end quote. Brown described Himmler as a snivelling coward, quote, "He was so frightened of what would happen to him. It was all aimed at saving his own skin," end quote. So instead of Captain Sylvester doling out cheese sandwiches and hot tea to a chatty Himmler who had voluntarily given his true identity, we have Brown's story, which sounds like Brown was present, or certainly arrived soon after these things had occurred. A warrant officer, that would be of the rank of Company Sergeant Major or Regimental Sergeant Major, a senior NCO, to use Brown's expression, kept at him and at him. He means the senior NCO had aggressively questioned the prisoner, whose identity documents were obvious fakes. Himmler's demeanour is also completely different, in Brown's version, of the unmasking of Himmler. Instead of being chatty and friendly, sitting opposite Sylvester's desk, discussing a letter he had written to Field Marshal Montgomery, Brown's Himmler was afraid for his life and very concerned to save his own skin. It would suggest that the manner of the interrogation was harsh. I'm not suggesting he was beaten up, but I think the way this senior NCO came at him was designed to frighten the prisoner into fessing up, and probably had overtures or suggestions of imminent violence. Where exactly this interrogation occurred is not noted by Brown in the interview. So why was Brown saying these things late in life? He seemed to certainly have his marbles right up to the day he died. Perhaps the treatment of Himmler didn't sit well with him. Perhaps he was proud of having taken part in the interrogation of Himmler and wanted some of it on record. and perhaps he chafed a bit at having his memoirs officially sanitized, as must have been the case, otherwise why was he talking about things that were not included in his official memoirs? Perhaps he was leaving a clue for a historian like me to find. After all, Brown's fan base was amongst the aviation enthusiasts, and the death of Himmler doesn't seem to be particularly in their ballpark. So is there any evidence that could corroborate the idea that Himmler was held in British captivity longer than admitted to? Well, yes, there is. In the British National Archives at Kew in London are the interrogation reports of Himmler's two adjutants, Grotmann and Macher. Grotmann was initially interviewed on the 24th of May 1945, and an interim report was issued by 21st Army Group on the 13th of June. Grotmann states that he, Macher, and Himmler were all captured together on the 21st of May 1945. Macher's interrogation report dated the 23rd of October 1945 says the same, captured 21st of May 1945. I suspect that Himmler was actually identified on the 21st of May as well, rather than the next day, the 22nd, which is the official story. If true, then Himmler was in British custody almost a day longer than admitted to, giving plenty of time for a more detailed interrogation by various interested parties. And was Eric Brown a representative of one of those interested parties? Two other pointers to some sort of official cover-up are the fact that the three-page war diary for May 1945 from the 2nd Army Defence Company, which guarded 31A Ulzenstrasse, where Himmler was taken and died, shows evidence of tampering. Researchers have noted that the second page of the three pages for May 1945 has, according to experts, been retyped by someone using the same typewriter but with a different typing style, who uses different ways of expressing numbers and names. The new page shows no entries between the 20th and the 23rd of May 1945, the latter, of course, being the date of the death of Himmler. Was the page retyped to conceal evidence that Himmler was in British captivity under his own name on the 21st and 22nd of May 1945? It appears the logical explanation, and also suggests that if this is true, that Himmler was at 31A Ulzenstrasse earlier than the 23rd of May 1945, as the record shows. Why else would he have been entered in the 2nd Army Defence Company war diary? It should be noted that war diaries were not typed one page at a time, but the entire month was typed up in one sitting. The three pages for May 1945 are also carbon copies, when the rest of the 1945 war diary for this unit are ribbon copies, that is, originals straight off the typewriter. All this has led some researchers to call out obvious interference and doctoring of the official record. For what purpose? Well, perhaps, if Grotmann and Macher are to be believed, to cover up the fact Himmler was in British custody for longer than admitted to. And also, as I have suggested in earlier videos, perhaps to cover up the manner of Himmler's death, what really happened. If Eric Brown was telling the truth in the talks and interviews that he gave, then his testimony has opened up for the first time fresh avenues to explore in trying to unravel the real story of the demise of Reichsfuhrer SS Heinrich Himmler in British captivity over 80 years ago.